ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, Kirsty Melville here, and welcome to the History Listen and to part two of the fascinating and moving Liar's Way Home. Joanna Kolofsky's family came to Australia to escape the Holocaust. Joanna is an internationally recognised mediator, and she served on the National Native Title Tribunal. But in 2019, she was contacted by a village in Germany with incredible news about her late grandparents, Liar and Adolf Semmler.
Out of the blue, I got an email from a name I didn't recognise, and I was absolutely blown away and delighted. A local historian had discovered that my grandmother was the last Jew to be deported from the village to a concentration camp. My grandfather Adolf, who was not Jewish, had gone to a slave labour camp rather than denounce her, and he was a hero of World War I.
Amazingly, both had survived, and now the village wanted to commemorate them. So in 2022, Joanna returned to Germany with her adult children, Michaela and Rick Kolofsky, who narrate this story. In this episode, the family pays an emotional visit to the slave labour camp where Joanna's grandfather, Adolf, was imprisoned. But first, as we pick up the story, Joanna has just laid stumbling stones, brass plates inscribed with her grandparents' names and the details of their ordeal outside where they lived, when a sudden disruption threatens to undo the occasion.
It had been one of the most moving events of our lives. Our mother, Joanna, had just laid the stumbling stones, or Stolpersteine, in front of the house our great-grandparents had been taken from in 1945. But now an old man, in his 80s or more, had gotten past the police who'd held him back through the ceremony and was steaming towards us with an anti-Semitic sign, ranting.
I'd often wondered how I'd react if ever faced with an actual pro-Nazi. I'm sure, like many Jews, I'd harboured heroic revenge fantasies. But seeing this old man coming at us aggressively, I felt none of that, because what he was saying wasn't Germany anymore. Even in our short time in Wenigsen, we could feel from nearly everyone we met their acceptance of the past, their real regret, determination to keep forging a different Germany, and above all, recognition that that was every individual's personal responsibility.
We'd come to find out the old man was, for want of a better description, the town crank. He'd been in and out of institutional care and had gotten worse since the death of his wife. He was why police had been at the Stumbling Stone ceremony. He wouldn't be at our second event, the other thing ensuring our great-grandmother would be remembered in Wenigsen. They were naming a new street after her, Liar Semmler Weg, Liar Semmler Way.
The new street is on the outskirts of town, in an area that for now is semi-rural, with new apartments and houses being built. In the fading light of dusk, it was beautiful. It was also full of young families and kids. Joe said Liar would have loved that.
My Orma would have been delighted to know that there are new babies in her street. And she would too. She loved looking at little babies.
That's the reason, Joanna thinks, she and Liar were so especially close. When Liar and Adolf reached Australia in mid-1947, Joanna was a baby of 6 months. Liar was ecstatic. Beyond the doomed infants on the train platform at Theresienstadt, she hadn't seen a living baby in years.
Joanna unveiled the new street.
Yay.
The street sign records Leia's birthplace, where she died, how long she lived in Wenigsen, and that she survived the Holocaust.
But wonderful as it was also ironic, as our mum said.
She couldn't have read it because both she and my grandfather were both illiterate.
Many of the street's young parents took time out from the early evening witching hour of dinner and bath to attend the unveiling, ask who Leia was, and take photos with their kids at the street sign. One couple told us they'd made a point of bringing their newborn baby girl. They wanted Liar's strong woman vibes to rub off on their daughter.
We also found out how Liar came to have the street named for her. Former Wenigsen City Councillor Christina Müller was at the unveiling. She had voted for it over many other ideas. For her, it was the power of Leia's story and a little luck.
We have a list from people that was transported to a Theresienstadt KZ, and it was a woman. Yeah. First, we just had the name and the birth date. And later, when we heard she overlived, we have been happy. It's a wonder, it's a present, and it's a gift. And therefore, a lot of people died. But these people from Wenigsen didn't die. And that's it's magic. And that you, the family, come to Wenigsen, it's amazing. It's amazing. Thank you for this.
We feel the same.
One thing we kept wondering about was whether people in Wenigsen could really have known for only 15 years that Jews had lived here. We got our answer when we met sociologist Dr. Wolfgang Schulz. He helped plan these commemorations and is an expert on Wenigsen's wartime history. As he explained it, the fact Wenigsen never had a synagogue had allowed some to believe there'd been no Jews here and so no Jewish persecution. But others, like a local Lutheran pastor in the 1960s, had suspected that Jews had been here and looked for the evidence. It was that research that first uncovered Leia's name, leading to eventual confirmation she'd lived here and to these commemorations.
Our first day had been mostly learning about Leia, but our second would be mostly about our great-grandfather Adolf and what he had experienced. We were going to the Holzen slave labour camp, where he'd been sent age 50 for refusing to denounce his Jewish wife, Leia. The next morning, as we prepared for the trip, our heads pounded. The night before, we'd been invited for a short tour of our great-grandparents' former home. It had turned into a long tour of the entire history of German wine.
But as we got on the bus for the slave labour camps, we sobered right up. We'd thought it was just Joanna, us, and our stepfather who were going. But already on board, waiting for us, was a local who's who. Historian Michael Wittisch, Mayor Inge Klockermann, local business figure Hans-Jürgen Herr, who he told us was therefore formerly known in German as Herr Herr.
And there was Harmut Rahmer, who had laid flowers on Leia and Adolf's stumbling stones the day before, after I'd first misjudged him. He was with his wife, Sibylla. None of these people had been obligated to come. They had wanted to. Again, the people of Wenigsen had showed the depth of their commitment to reconciliation and to us.
An hour and a half later, we arrived at Stollen Gustav, Gustav Forest, site of Adolf's slave labour camp, Holzen. Our guide was Frau Jutta Henser, a former teacher. She's extensively researched the area's slave labour camps and was raised and lives in a nearby village.
Asphalt has long been mined here. And mines are why the Nazis came, Frau Henser explained.
Die Nazis waren unter großem Druck, weil die Lufthoheit an die Alliierten übergegangen war.
Because the Allies suddenly took control of the air, German munitions factories were all targeted, and so they moved a whole industrial complex to here.
Germany planned to rebuild its war machine underground in the disused mines.
Das war im VW-Werk Ferdinand Porsche. Und das war Werner von Braun.
Overseeing the plan were Ferdinand Porsche, Karl Braun founder, an enthusiastic Nazi, and Werner von Braun. The day before, we'd been stunned to see von Braun memorialised as a great scientist on the big sundial in Wenigsen. Von Braun had designed the V2 rockets that devastated European cities later in the war, killing and maiming tens of thousands of civilians in London, Antwerp and elsewhere. Those bombings had no real strategic value. They were little more than Hitler's revenge for Allied bombings of German cities that had military capability.
Since the war, there have been attempts to rehabilitate von Braun's reputation. He was given a pass for his Nazi activities in exchange for coming to America to work for the US Army on its ballistic missile program. He made films with Walt Disney. Then he joined NASA.
But von Braun was an arch war criminal. His plan to build weapons underground here was the very reason for the slave labour. The slaves were needed to transport the parts and equipment to the mines.
Adolf Semler hat hier gearbeitet in diesem Stollen. Die Arbeiten bestanden darin, die Stollen weiter auszubauen. Das heißt, die
Zwangsarbeiter. Here at Holzen is where Adolf was held as a slave. Nazi laws didn't recognize his earlier conversion to Judaism, but he was now deemed Halbjuden, half Jew, for being married to a Jew and not denouncing her.
Slaves like Adolf had to work with their bare hands, Frau Henze said, including to build their own barracks. Before that, they slept outside. It was February, winter. It could get to minus 30. Even now, in midsummer, the forest felt different.
As soon as you walk into the shade here, you feel how cold it is. I can only imagine how cold it must have been for Adolf Semmler, for Orpa, and for all the other men who worked here non-stop.
Adolf wasn't the only man sent to slave labour for having a Jewish wife. At 50, he wasn't even the oldest. Frau Henze told, and Joe translated, the story of a man from Frau Henze's own village.
There was a man in the village who was married to a Jewish woman, and right at the end of the war, she was arrested and taken to Theresienstadt. And unlike my grandmother, she was moved on to Auschwitz. And on the way to Auschwitz, she uses the word verschollen, which means disappeared, and it either means that she died on the transport or that something happened to her. She was killed in some way. And the Christian husband who had, so to speak, like my grandfather, protected her during the war, went to see the Bürgermeister, the mayor of that little town, and he said, I've only got one thing to say to you. I hope that what happened to my wife one day happens to yours, that you suffer my fate. He immediately denounced him to the Nazis, and he immediately came to slave labor and didn't survive.
Da waren Ostarbeiter. Polen, Tschechen,
husbands who refused to abandon Jewish wives were also not the only types of slaves here. Ostarbeiter, East European soldiers captured on that front, were also brought to Holzen.
Das ist die Baracke, in der gelebt hat, also wo geschlafen hat.
Holzen's slave barracks no longer exist, but we walked to where they were and we saw the stone foundations. We were amazed to learn the site had been found just 1 week before. Historian Michael Wittisch had used wartime maps to locate the Holzen slave barracks on the floor of the forest. By total coincidence, we were visiting just days later. Wittisch let us dig around in the foundations. We were among the first ever to do so.
Wittisch's research is so meticulous, he was even able to show us exactly where Adolf had slept, the Halbjuden area, room 2. That allowed our family, in accordance with Jewish custom, to lay stones there in Adolf's memory.
John's putting his stone here, where Orpa slept.
From Holzen, we then travelled to the Lennar slave labour camp, about an hour away. Its slave barracks have been maintained as a small museum and memorial. It brought home viscerally what slave labour must have been like. Even on a hot summer day, once again in here it was really cold and nearly pitch black.
The walls of Lennar's slave barracks are covered in displays on the forced work done and slaves imprisoned here. The railway track that slaves took down to the mines, pushing metal carts full of heavy equipment and stones, has been maintained. On each rail track is the name of a German company, some like VW, still in business, that helped make Nazi weapons using slave labour.
Particularly haunting was a display about a Polish woman, Christina. With her mother, she was brought here and forced to work as slave labour for VW from 1940 to 1945. Businessman Lars Fahrenbach, who'd been our drinking buddy the night before, also came with us to see the slave labour camps, and he translated Christina's testimony.
So as soon as we have broken a regulation, we have been sent to a special treatment camp. I was suffering all my life. My youth was stolen, and that I had to stay 5 years in Germany from when I was 15 to 20, and that I was not allowed to make any kind of formal education. I was suffering the rest of my life from this punishment.
It took us all a moment to realise what this meant. Not only were women slave labourers, they were kept in the same barracks as men. But it was even worse than that. As Frau Henze explained, the women were not allowed to sleep separately from the men. Some of these women became pregnant, whether from consensual experiences or not, we don't know, and gave birth here. An old man from the area has recalled as a child seeing a newborn baby being brought from these barracks. None of these women ever saw their babies again.
Es wurde ja immer größer, dieses Problem der Geburten in den Lagern.
The babies were given to women from the local village, but the women were instructed to leave their windows open in the hope the babies would die of exposure. When the village women objected, the babies that were of Aryan enough appearance were given to other German couples. We can only guess the fate of the rest of the babies.
The mood was somber as we finished our tour of the slave labour camps, even as Wittisch told us about Laia and Adolf's comparatively happy ending. Adolf and his fellow slaves were liberated by American troops in April 1945. As in many other cases, the slave labourers were in such shock, initially they wouldn't leave. Laia was liberated when the Theresienstadt concentration camp was found by Russian troops a month later. But she was so sick with tuberculosis, she wouldn't leave for another 3 months.
Adolf had promised Laia they'd both survive and reunite. But
imagine how hard it was for people to find each other again in the chaos of post-war Germany, post-war Europe. Laia, when she was well enough, was able to say to the Red Cross that if her husband was alive, he would be in Wenigsen. And he was. He walked 5 kilometres there and back every day and sat in the town square, because every day the Red Cross came and read a list of survivors. And eventually, she was on that list and he was able to identify himself as her husband, and so they were reunited.
Their daughter Rose, Joanna's mother and our grandmother, had left Germany for Australia in the late 1930s. From almost the moment of her arrival, she was also trying to get Laia and Adolf out.
Here is a letter written by my mother, Rose, to her parents in Hannover, on the 17th of November 1939, so very shortly after she arrived when war had already broken out. And she writes, "Ich will euch euer Herz nicht schwer machen, sondern euch nur sagen, dass ich sehnlichst auf Frieden hoffe und dann wird es mit Gottes Hilfe auch nicht mehr lange dauern, bis ich euch hier bei mir habe. I don't want to make you sad." She says, "I don't want to give you a heavy heart, but I just want to say that I most deeply hope for peace. And then, with God's help, it won't be long before I have you here with me."
In fact, it would be another 8 years.
Laia and Adolf had not been able to join Rose because under Australia's refugee rules, they were too old. Now, after the war, Australia still wouldn't admit them, this time until Laia could prove she was fully tuberculosis-free. So they returned to Wenigsen to live again in the house on what is now Neustadtstrasse, the house they'd been arrested and taken from. Even after all they'd endured, it was they who were trying to comfort their daughter, Rose.
This is a letter plainly written for them by a scribe. And this is a classic of what I think survivors do in all kinds of circumstances to reassure those who are worrying about them. They write, "Hier ist jetzt wundervoller Frühling. Ihr müsstet mal mit dem Flugzeug herüberkommen können und die Baumblüte genießen. Es wird auch schon wärmer und wir erholen uns hier in der frischen Landluft ganz gut. Macht euch nur keine Sorgen. Hier, it's a wonderful spring. You should take a plane and come over and see these beautiful flowers on the trees, die Baumblüte. It's also getting warmer and we are recovering in the fresh air of the countryside. Just don't worry about us." And this is 7th of May, 1946.
so barely a year after liberation.
They finally arrived in Australia in June 1947.
Although Joanna remembers our great-grandparents barely speaking of their wartime experiences, she saw their effect on Leia.
I remember that when I woke up from an afternoon nap, I would often see Leia sitting in a chair crying. I'm sure it's why I cry so much. She had a photo of Michaela, her other granddaughter, who died aged 7.
Michaela was the daughter of Leia's only other child, her son Bernard. Like Rose, Bernard had left Germany in the late 1930s, in his case for what was then Palestine. Jo explained what happened to Michaela.
She suffered from middle ear infections, and when the port was blockaded, there was no access to medicine, and she died of overwhelming infection.
There was more tragedy to come. Michaela died during the Arab-Israeli War of 1948. Her father, Bernard, attended the funeral in his military uniform. He was shot and killed by an enemy sniper. His wife, Rali, had lost her only child and her husband, both within a day of each other.
Leia died in 1975, at nearly 86. Even at the end, she hadn't forgotten the war.
When Orma was very elderly, shortly before her death, she went to an old people's home and she'd stopped speaking for some reason. The Jewish geriatrician who came to see Leia was wearing on a chain a Star of David, which fell out of his shirt as he leaned over her to examine her, at which moment she immediately put her finger to her lips and gestured him to come closer and told him to keep very quiet and not to speak and to hide the Star of David so that nobody would know that he or she was a Jew. And when the geriatrician reassured her that she was quite safe, she started speaking again and spoke until she died.
Adolf lived until 1980, dying at the age of 85. As we walked through the Holzen slave labour site in the forest, Joanna poignantly recalled her Orpah's end.
Will you tell me again the story you told me about how you cut Orpah's nails?
When Orpah lost his sight, and he could still shave, but he couldn't cut his nails the way he liked. So from the time he became blind, shortly after that, he asked me if I would do his nails, and I used to go regularly to see him every week, and I would cut his nails, and sometimes...
Would you take me sometimes?
I took you, and I took Rick, and towards the end of his life, he really wanted not to be here anymore. And he started talking about it on a regular basis. And one day I went with you to see him with all my equipment. And he said, please, you know, don't cut my nails. And I said, why? And he said, because I really want to die. And if you touch me, I will want to stay. I will want to stay. And the next week, he very quietly died. He was such a determined man that I think if he'd wanted to die here, he would have found a way. But he wanted to be alive. And he spent another 30 years being alive with Orma and with us. So I think he had the pleasure of coming to Australia and seeing a new world.
It was time to leave Venixen. They had been incredible days. We promised to stay in touch, and we have, with historians Michael Wittisch and Wolfgang Schulz. Hamut Rama has invited us to become honorary members of the German anti-fascist party, VVN, whose flag he carried at the Stumbling Stone ceremony. Rick's oldest son, Malachi, 18, also recently visited, detouring from his end of high school backpacking trip with mates to visit Venixen, see his great-great-grandparents' stumbling stones, as well as Liars Street.
We don't yet know how many other Jews lived in Weinixen before the war or what happened to them. But Laia was almost certainly the last Weinixen Jew, woman or man, to be sent to a concentration camp. She may even be the only Weinixen Jew sent to a concentration camp who survived. After grit and luck, the other reason was Adolf, who so successfully prevented her capture until so late in the war. To us, both of them are truly history makers.
But it's the impact on our mother, Joanna, that has been the most profound. We asked her to reflect on what all this has meant to her.
I spent all those years on the Native Title Tribunal. And I used to come home and say to John, I don't know my own country. I didn't know its history. I felt ashamed. And I particularly felt ashamed not to have known, because once you know, there's no turning back. The truth is, much as it irks me to say so, the Germans have done more in 80 years, 60 years certainly, because the first 20 years after the war, they just didn't want to know. They couldn't face themselves. But they've done more in that time than I believe we have in Australia, and we still have that to do. A wonderful Aboriginal colleague of mine once said to me that I over-identify. He said, you over-identify with us. Leave it to us. Just leave it alone. We can manage without you, you know. And he also used to say, don't speak for us. We can speak for ourselves. We don't need any more white people to speak for us. And now I feel that's happening to me. That I'm saying to people in this town, in a not even a roundabout way, in a direct way, we are here. You wanted us not to be here. You pretended we weren't. You tried to wipe us out, but we are here, and we're not going to be angry and resentful. We're going to make change. And I think that's the most important part of this trip. And you can't do other people's business if you haven't done your own.
That was the second and last episode of Laia's Way Home. It was written and presented by Michaela and Rick Kolofsky. Research assistance by Tig Kolofsky. Produced by Claudia Taranto. Sound engineer was Hamish Camilleri. I'm Kirsty Melville, and I'll catch you next time on The History Listen. See you then.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.